rolling. My name is Paul Rohde. I'm at Holden this fall. Stirring our program conversations around a theme of migrants and pilgrims, people in exile, on the move, various biblical metaphors that we give them. When Carol introduced this in Vespers a week ago, she said she had consulted a thesaurus and found that there were 35 names for people on the move. I had planned to start the session anyway that way to say, how many names can you think of for people on the move? Having done this session twice already, we still only come up with 20-some names. But I'm curious what names you bring for people on the move. What do you think about?
Voyager.
Right.
Hobo. We didn't have hobo. We're up to 27.
Sojourner.
Mm-hmm.
Migrant.
Yeah.
Rover.
You're good. You are a walking thesaurus.
Vagabond.
Mm-hmm. Exile. Nomad. Those were one.
Refugee.
Uh-huh. Come on in. We're just getting started. We're offering words for people on the move.
For people where? On the moon?
People on the move.
On the moon.
Yeah, or on the moon. You would have to move a piece.
Astronaut.
Well, an astronaut is a person on the moon.
We just got back from hiking. We barely had dinner. We're kind of goofy.
Hikers are people on the moon.
Yeah, we are on the moon.
There you go.
Voyager.
Thank you,
Martin.
There's probably a ton of terminology for soldiers on the move.
Deployed.
There you go. Yeah. We haven't used any machines yet in these words. You could think of canoeist and cyclist. I had written down hog for certain kinds of cyclists. I'm impressed that we've done all this and nobody has said the word tourist yet. Or sightseer, vacationer, traveler. Now, just as you think about those words, what makes them like pilgrims, or how might a pilgrim be different?
A pilgrim is more intentional.
Okay. Good.
I think of a pilgrim as being intentional with one purpose, rather than a vague purpose.
Yeah.
I mean,
intentionality and purpose.
It's a spiritual connection to me, mm-hmm. Pilgrim.
Right, it is a spiritual kind of journey. Mm-hmm. We may think another word for people on the move is a missionary, or someone on a mission is somebody who's moving. That probably gets a little closer to pilgrim in a way, explorer. Another word for people on the move that we haven't said that has religious import is crusader. Mm-hmm. And when you study the history of pilgrimage, that's an important word, because some of the pilgrims were also on a crusade to conquer lands and get them back for Christianity. When I started this project, I really thought I would define pilgrim between tourist on the one side and crusader on the other. But the more I explore it, the more impressed I am that really all the words have something to offer. And the kind of theology that I'll bring to pilgrimage is one that's deeply incarnational, meaning in the flesh, and believing that God is a part of everything, and we discover God as creator and redeemer and sustainer in all these places. And pilgrims, I think, are people who are about that discovery. My teacher is largely Ian Bradley. He's a scholar at St. Andrews in Scotland. He's published a wonderful book with color photographs and travel tips if you want to go to any of the pilgrimage sites in Europe. Because he's Scottish, he's only included pilgrimage sites in Europe. But he gives wonderful descriptions for how to get there and what you could expect to learn in any of those places. And he encourages us, as he talks about pilgrims, not to draw the distinctions too firmly. For example, the conversation we had over here was right on target. We think of pilgrims being intentional or having purpose, as opposed to nomads and wanderers and so on. But you read the pilgrimage literature and discover that a lot of the times that pilgrims make a discovery of God, they have been sidetracked or detoured or lost something has gone awry, and they're having to figure things out by a different way. In fact, when I think of pilgrims, some of the first biblical characters I think of are the wise men. And the scripture says so beautifully, they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod, and they went home by another way. This pursuit of another way that may not be linear. It may be more wandering and nomadic, like any hike. I mean, you never know when it's going to happen.
You sure don't.
Okay, I speak truth. And similarly with tourists, I read interesting kinds of things. I've got a quotation in my project that where a woman who had walked the Camino in Spain said, a tourist is in it for themselves, and a pilgrim is in for others, and aware of those who walk with them. Well, I frankly think that's a little harsh. I mean, I would want to believe that even when I'm being a tourist, the Good Samaritan story lives deeply enough in me that if I see somebody by the side of the road, I'd be willing to stop. My wife and I studied with Ian Bradley at Iona in Scotland a year ago, and Iona gets thousands of visitors a day. And some of my notes, I have down the exact number. I think it's 250,000 visitors a year. This teeny tiny island, most of them are tourists. They come in on a ferry and they walk around and they take a few pictures and they leave. But mercifully, Ian Bradley observes that they get to the Abbey, some of them will stop for a time. And some of them will light a candle. They can appear to be praying, see? And so some of these lines we want to draw aren't as neat as we may want to think they are. We think about tourists buying souvenirs, and that's a souvenir shop is classic tourism, is it not? But pilgrims also tend to bring things back. One of the stops on our Iona pilgrimage was the Bay of Colombo, where our exercise at that spot was to throw a rock into the bay as a symbol for something we wanted to let go of, and then take a second rock with us to remember that we had done it. I still have my rock. Maybe it's not as glitzy as a souvenir, but maybe souvenirs aren't always glitzy as we make. We even at Holden, we sell some souvenirs, right? So it begs the question, what exactly is a pilgrim, and how do we want to talk about that? And what I'm going to try to do in this session is just give you a few touchstones, characteristics, descriptors. And as it goes with spiritual practices, every one of them is connected to every other one of them. So I had a horrible time getting a decent outline, speech major though I am. So I finally came up with a very imaginative structure. It is beginning, middle, and end. every trip, which is fine like what a pilgrimage is, it is some kind of trip, starts with a departure. Or a leaving, a going or a letting go. From the outset, I like to begin that the very first word spoken to Abraham in Genesis 12 was the word go. And the last word spoken by Jesus to the disciples before his ascension, at least in the Gospel of Matthew, where we have the Great Commission, is again the word go. Go make disciples of all nations. So the word go brackets the scripture. There is something very clear about movement. And the first thing that I want to say about a pilgrim is that a pilgrim goes. But the next thing I want to say is that they go not merely from geography, usually involves a geographic departure, but there's also a leaving of some sense of self or the world or certainty or God. There is this letting go of self, which of course is also deeply rooted in the gospel. Whoever would save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life, lets it go, will find it. Sometime in this month, I'm hoping we're going to find an hour to just get together and tell departure stories. One of the things, having come to Holden now for years, that has been really fun is hearing the intensity with which people getting here need to tell about how they got here. because things happen on the, well, you see, there are probably some departure stories in this very room. If somebody has one, we can take a moment for it. That would be great.
Well, we left with enough time. If Marilyn had remembered her purse,
yes,
we didn't have to.
But it takes a village for Marilyn too.
And if there wasn't somebody pulling a boat over Snoqualmie Pass or Bullet Pass, or and so I was on staff at the bed and breakfast, so I was very familiar with the part after you get off Blue, no, getting on Bullet Pass and all the rest of the way. And I also don't tend to just drive the speed limit. I sometimes go a little over.
A little?
So Marilyn, who drives under the speed limit mostly, and I looked at the clock and I said, we are going to miss the boat. And so I got in the driver's seat. And I said, we are going to miss the boat, but we're going to give it our best shot not to miss the boat. So as we, you know, when you come down and you can see the lake for the first time, and so I said, okay, I have my eyes on the road. You guys look for the boat. And they said, oh, it's way over there. I said, I don't think we're going to make it because this truck was in front of me. And I was on his bumper, and I hate it when people do it to me, but I really didn't want to miss the boat. So he didn't get over. He didn't get over, and he couldn't pass. So finally, I could pass. And then Eunice said, we're ahead of the boat.
You have a departure saga. Amen, sister. That
Lord
is.
Works in mysterious ways.
So, in some ways, our conversation this fall has these questions: what are we letting go of? And then, what happens as we tell the story? So, it's penning the pilgrimage. What happens as we give that narrative, give that description? We don't need to answer that right at this moment. But I would be interested in opinions about what this quartet gave up.
Safety.
Their luggage in the lake.
The fear that my son-in-law is a state patrol and he would find out.
Well, you gave up fear or found a little fear.
But we had to cooperate because instead of everybody saying something, it was like, okay, now, when we get there, everybody has to have their job. So as soon as you hit the brake, everybody went in their own direction. And we were able to do that. So.
Great. You gave up a lot of autonomy.
Right.
I think they gave up control. They gave up control.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Is giving up control related to faith? Is that a faith issue? Related to transformation? I think it's huge. One of my favorite getting to Holden stories was a colleague on the Holden board who ran into a moose. You laugh. People always laugh when they hit him. He could have been killed.
He literally really
ran into a moose. Yeah. It was huge. It was a day late, but he made it. You know. So we've got this. And the other thing that I want us to identify here is that pilgrimage is a practice, which I like to say is an embodied action. It's one thing to sit around and think about becoming new or changing or transforming. It's another thing to be in a car that needs to make the boat, and you've got to deal with it, or to land in a place that speaks a different language, or to be lost. One of our rituals in coming to Holden, and I think it screams volumes about letting go, is getting into our room after lunch. We've gotten our luggage. And the first thing we do, Susan was so ceremonial about it this time because we love this about Holden. We find a drawer, and we put our boat tickets and our billfolds and our keys in it, and we are free people. We don't need a billfold. If I need money for ice cream, somebody owes me. Last summer when I was here, Karen didn't have her billfold. I bought her ice cream. But letting go of that, how many places in the world can you let go of your keys and your ID and your credit cards in? And what happens when you let it go? And I think there are people who struggle with that. There are people who would carry it on a hike. But if you have a challenge between here and Holden Lake, your billfold isn't going to do you. It is this trust, these other things. The word practice is really important because after the Enlightenment, we have tended to separate thinking about things and doing them. And I want to talk about practices in a way that puts them together. If I can find this quotation quickly. It's by Miroslav Volf, and it speaks beautifully about the importance of theology also being practiced. Miroslav Volf teaches at Yale. My contention is that at the heart of every good theology lies not simply a plausible intellectual vision, we could say a plan or a definition or something, but more importantly, a compelling account of a way of life. And that theology is therefore best done from within the pursuit of this way of life. So to talk about letting go is better when you're going somewhere, when you're actually doing it. I think to talk about forgiveness, it's okay to talk about forgiveness in a circle like this. We do it all the time in a room like this. But finally, forgiveness as a way of life is to be face to face with the person you have wronged or who has wronged you. And it is to speak of a way of life. And it's important not to get forgiveness defined apart from that way of life and that encounter. And that's what practice means. And I think even in seminary curricula, there's been a danger of separating definitions and understandings of God from life with God, living in and for God. And one of the reasons I love pilgrimage as a practice and as a way of talking about all of faithful practice is because you have to do it and you get yourself into a situation and you have to deal with it. You've let go of, I mean, another thing, I didn't hear this so much, it may be the forgotten purse, but we often let go of security. We let go of what we think will make us secure, or we certainly let go of some comfort. We let go of predictability. All of these kinds of things are involved in this letting go. Listen to the way that Daniel Taylor, he was a pilgrim also to the Celtic sites in Great Britain, wrote a book called In Search of Sacred Places. He's an English teacher at Bethel University in the Twin Cities. As we pass over the Sound to the island, I reflect on the stages of travel that have brought me to Iona, to England by jet, to Cambridge by train, to the south coast and then Oban by car, to Mull by car ferry, and now on to Iona by passenger ferry. And then while on Iona, only by foot. That sound like any place you've gone lately? This physical progression is the outward dimension of a necessary process of shedding that must go on at many levels if one is to approach the sacred. My technological crutches become ever more simple and then disappear. Plane, train, car, ferry, feet. The physical scale continually shrinks from North American continent to island nation, to small island of Mull, to tiny island of Iona. An island, off an island, off an island. It feels as if I am approaching the edge of something, and I'm not altogether happy about it. I'm sure it's not only external things, planes and cars that must be shed. Surely an inward kind of giving up and simplifying is also required if I'm to be more than a tourist on Iona. And that, of course, would be uncomfortable. I think it is uncomfortable. I believe that Christian faith is about letting go of all the things we've described. And that finally, at the depth of Christian faith, it's to say even, It's letting go of life for the sake of living anew. Dying to rise. Don't we use all of that language? And that is, of course, uncomfortable. So when we speak of pilgrimage, of going, one of the things that will characterize this departure is something that we call liminal space. The word literally means a threshold. It's space in between, where you've left something, but you've not yet arrived somewhere else, and you're in between, you're suspended, in suspense, all of those kinds of things apply. And the best way to describe this is to think about life transformations. And we become immediately aware how we ritualize these transformations. So graduation is a huge liminal space. And you wear the mortarboard, and you get in line, and they call your name, and you are no longer a student, and you are an alum. But what else you are going to be is sort of yet to be determined. You're in between. A wedding is a great example of liminal space. Though the people coming to the wedding think they know what they're getting themselves into, those of us who've done it for a while find that humorous. You don't really know what's coming. You know, the one thing you know is that life will not be the same, that there's no going back. But what it is to go forward, that is this uncertainty. I think pilgrimage is a practice that helps us practice that uncertainty, rehearse it in some safe kinds of ways. One of the most challenging questions I was given, as we discussed this last week, was to distinguish between chosen and forced pilgrimages. And I said to the person who asked the question that I think that's a false distinction. I think Americans are very much into autonomy and choice. We like to think that the things we choose are the very most important things. There's a sense in which we're all on a chosen pilgrimage, if you're going to see it that way. Nobody forced us to come to Holden Village. We chose to get on the boat. Gave a huge sigh of relief when it happened. But I think those moments, those turning points in an adventure, in a journey, where you face the letting go of something, is rarely chosen. When you've lost something, or encountered something, learned something. I mean, one of the things that gets very involved in pilgrimage as a practice is meeting strangers. And sometimes that means meeting whole categories of people that we consider strange for one reason or another. Well, you may be choosing your trip, but when that encounter thrusts the humanity of another person in front of you, I don't think you're choosing that anymore. And you, even if you pull back from it and don't deal with it immediately, it is going to have its effect. Love of neighbor is like love. And so some of those letting go, the letting go of control, we may choose that to a certain extent, but mostly I think that's something that happens to us. So one of the, this gets me back to all our terms for people on the move. We might want to say a pilgrimage is not a vacation until we realize that the root word of vacation is to vacate. And maybe a pilgrimage isn't empty of oneself, in the very best sense of the word. Kendra Creasy Dean grounds this emptying, this letting go, in a theology of the cross. She says, pilgrimages are journeying practices. They are designed to traverse new territory, both within and without, in order to move us closer to the cross. Every pilgrimage, therefore, leads to Jerusalem in either literal or metaphorical ways. So the other question I got this week that was really challenging is a pilgrimage safe? Isn't it kind of a safe thing? Well, yes, it is. It's safer than really giving up your life, totally giving it up. You buy a round-trip ticket. So there is that safety. But it's certainly riskier than doing nothing. It is, in a sense, moving into the unknown and practicing, if you let it be, it's practicing ways that we're always being moved. Kendrick Dean adds a couple of other words to this liminal space. She'll talk about boundary breaking or dehabituating. I think dehabituating is an interesting word. We have our habits, we have our routines, and a trip breaks us out of those, if we let them. Or a pilgrimage, whether or not it's a trip, breaks us out of those. Any comments, questions about that beginning, going, letting go of self and understanding of the world? Go ahead.
I'm struck with conversations I had here before last. We had a young Muslim live with us for the year who described the Muslim pilgrimage.
The Hajj.
Yes, that his mother had done. And I don't know a lot about the details, but I know that it's required if it's at all possible, and that it was a significant event in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, not as safe as she had hoped, she would feel as safe. And I wonder how much of the pilgrimage to Mecca, at least for Muslims, isn't just in some ways an act of surrender and obedience because it's part of their law. In which case, pilgrimage takes on another layer.
Surrender and obedience being the other layer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when you surrender to love or to God, I think when you're most honest with yourself, you don't know what it's going to take. You really don't know. One of the things that excites me about this as a practice is the place of intersection it may provide for us with other faiths that also practice, that we can find some things in common and learn from them. Did you have a comment?
I was just going to say, as I age and look back, you can see parts of your life where these kinds of different things happen. And at the time, it might have been very uncomfortable or very painful. But looking back, then you can see that it was a great opportunity for growth.
Right.
But at the time, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. The former presiding bishop of the ELC, H. Jerry Anderson, had this great illustration. Said, you know, we like stability. We like to be balanced on both feet like this. And then something comes from behind you and gives you a shove and you know, whatever kind of routine like that. And you think you saved yourself from falling. And everybody else thinks you finally took a step forward.
I was just, when you were talking about the uncomfortableness, I was reminded of a guy who I was friends with in my 20s, who had a big impact on my life. His day job was he lectured at the University of Minnesota to medical students on the subject of death, because they were the most ignorant group on this subject. Their entire professional life was being spent to avoid this subject, and so dealing with it was particularly tough for them. He's a psychiatrist, but he also gave presentations in various Twin Cities churches on the subject of loneliness and grief. And I remember one particular comment of his that's always stuck with me. He said, ask anyone, when in your life do you feel you matured, whatever language you want to use, you matured most as a person, that you grew spiritually, that you bloomed, whatever you want to use. And 9 times out of 10, they will mention a tragedy. Mm-hmm. My father died, the divorce, the death of the child, you know. These are the moments that they self-identify as those times when they really grew. And then, of course, the follow-up question, would you go through that again, given the pronounced benefit that you seem to have received from this? Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that you find in the pilgrimage literature all over the place is language of transformation. Or renewal, which is another word for blossom, or, you know, when have you been transformed? And I mean, Holden exists as a renewal ministry. We are about helping church, world, people become new. It's hard to get honest about the old needing to go. And that's what this liminal space is about. That's what departure, letting go, is about. Well, go ahead, Lisa.
No, you were talking about the safety of it and buy a round trip ticket and all this stuff, but I just was thinking about pilgrimages and really that, you know, you say just leave, it's like a, how did you say it, was a short version or something? Like,
well, it's a rehearsal.
Rehearsal, yes. But I think in a way it's just the first step and a beginning, because if I think about pilgrimages and what those, it's just the beginning of, it's not really this thing that, because I was thinking of one, and it was like, yeah, it was just this trip, but then what else, it's triggered in my life. I mean, where I am right now began from that first pilgrimage, so.
Yeah, I think external, internal contrast there is helpful, that externally it may not be so risky. But if you open yourself to the possibility that you will be changed, that can be scary. Or if you refuse to open yourself to that may be scarier still. Any other comments? So then we will move on to the middle. Or I'm tempted to say the vast middle. Every hiker at Holden knows that Cloudy Pass is not merely about packing your backpack and enjoying the view. It's about several thousand steps in between, and who knows how many interruptions, disruptions, all of those kinds of things. There was a television documentary made at Lindisfarne, Holy Island. Lindisfarne is one of the pilgrimage sites off the west coast of England. And for the sake of a TV camera, the pilgrims tried to make what a pilgrimage was visible. So to use actions and props so that people could see it. This is their account. Their departure is marked by things they leave behind. They relinquish handbags and cell phones. Some of them take off their shoes to reenact Moses' reverence for holy ground. Each of them bids a quiet farewell to companions who remain behind. I forgot to tell you, Lindisfarne is an island at high tide, but at low tide it's a peninsula. So pilgrims to Lindisfarne can only walk there at low tide, and you need to time your coming and going. So you either get off before high tide comes or you plan to stay 12 hours till the next low tide. Their way across the isthmus, available only at low tide, is defined by a series of markers that help the pilgrims know where to walk. At each marker, the pilgrims enact practices that have characterized pilgrimage through the ages. They stop to read, pray, and write. They engage one another. When one of them stumbles or loses his way, another responds. The risk and peril of the way is depicted for the camera by a rescue tower. These rescue towers actually exist midway along the isthmus. So if you don't make it, high tide is coming in. You climb up this little tower and sit there for 12 hours till the tide goes back up. A rescue tower, a dramatic flight of stairs to an elevated platform to provide refuge for the unfortunate pilgrim whose journey is interrupted by high tide. The pilgrims choose to mark their arrivals with rituals of encounter. A servant prepares to wash their feet. Another is making breakfast, reminiscent of the resurrected Jesus, meeting disciples on the shore of Galilee, or Cleopas on the road to Emmaus. Others dance with new or renewed relationship. So we've got these markers along the way, and they talked about reading and praying and writing. The other practice we're exploring in this fall program is the practice of journal keeping, of narrating. One of my heroes is Paul Ricoeur, who says that life is a story in search of a narrator. And I believe, along with several other journal keepers, that until we bring our lives to language, we don't even really see them. The word that, for me, that really captured, well, movement captures the middle of a pilgrimage, but the other word is attentiveness. Tonight in Vespers, our theme is going to be attentiveness. Paying attention. Noticing, seeing, and looking again because you don't see it all the first time. Going back to some place you've been 100 times and seeing something you've never noticed before. Paying attention to ordinary things. One of the reasons hiking, I think, is a great picture of pilgrimage is because you become so aware on a hike of what you carry. Your baggage, how much you're carrying around, you feel it in every step. And you make different choices out of that awareness and out of that attentiveness. So in the middle of a pilgrimage, you become aware that it's a meta practice. It's like worship, which includes welcoming and listening and eating and singing, encountering one another. A pilgrimage does too. Meeting other people, companions. I'm tickled that the pilgrimage literature is just littered with people who are driven crazy by their companions. They're seeking out a profound spiritual experience, and all these people they can't stand keep getting in the way. And lo and behold, that calls for a little more liminality. The seeing of self that can't stand these people, the changing of one's own perception, the profound experience of being helped and
think
of helping another.
The Canterbury Tales.
Exactly, yeah. Or Pilgrim's Progress, mm-hmm. which begins in the Slough of Despond. You know, and all of the people who try to discourage Pilgrim on the way. That's exactly right. One of my companions gave a devotion recently after he'd been on a vacation at a committee meeting on our campus. And he said that he felt like his senses were so stimulated by being away from home and out of his element that it was like using them for the first time. One of the things that I think is another part of this liminality of going through a tragedy or a transforming experience is how much more acutely aware you become of what's around you and what's in you. You see more clearly, you feel more intensely. So even common words take on new meaning. And at this stage, I like to interject that both journey and journal come from the root of the French word jour, which means day. A journey was originally as far as you could get in a day. And there are any number of pilgrimages where all you can deal with is that day. I'm thinking about, wilderness backpack trips where you've got lousy weather, or we have a cousin in Alaska who is in the backcountry hunting, and the float plane needed to get back to them to pick them up. The wind was too strong to get there, and they just had to deal with it. And they just had to deal with the day. They were not ready to get out that day, and hope for better the next day. Deal with it a day at a time. We're watching the Tolkien trilogy, and when I first put this together, we had just seen Fellowship of the Ring, and my favorite part of it was that motley crew of companions for Frodo. If you're into the Tolkien book, you know, I don't have the names all written down here, but they range from wizards to weirdos, yeah, and everything in between. But they are loyal to each other and helpful to each other. And in this respect, pilgrimage is a great metaphor for church and this gathering of people. Perseverance and support, the intersection of the earthly and the spiritual axis, all of these things that become a part of the middle. And the key that we pay attention to them, I want to say that we bring language to them. We listen to others who have been on the way, what they have experienced, there's much to garner from that. Any reaction to just this quick survey over the middle, and then we'll try to talk a little bit about destinations.
I reacted to the, when you're walking along and you meet a stranger and the stranger kind of drives you crazy. We think of it also metaphorically, often the stranger, the behavior that drives us crazy is a behavior that's within ourselves. So it becomes our internal yuck is externalized, and we have to deal with that.
That's exactly
to accept the internal aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah.
And then to even go a little odder is the use of language is what we know neurologically is when we can name things. It helps us process things better. Mm-hmm. So there's actually in that field that they can actually look at the way the brain functions and how that works with it. So putting all of those things together helps in the journey because it helps the way the brain processes, because we are very cognitive, but the meeting the stranger is not as cognitive. It's more the heart, the soul, the non-cognitive aspect.
Right. Yeah, there are lots of things involved in that. We're cognitive, and putting it into language is a part of that. Putting it into a story is about putting it into coherence. helping it make sense so that the story moves along. You aren't always at this place. It changes. It develops. And you write it out, finding as I journal that it starts in a place and it takes me to other places that I weren't aware of and helps us move through that. There's a very interesting study now that's about cognition and the effect of the internet, and that as opposed to thinking in stories where ideas are connected, when you read a book, there is a flow. You've got these images. You're on one website, then you go to the next website, then you go to the next website, and they're not connected. And seeing the world as a series of snapshots as opposed to seeing the world as a story. Part of the middle of a pilgrimage is to bring it to a story and to let it be 100 stories, if you remember. The insight about seeing in a mirror is huge. Finally, we've always got to be thinking about whether we're seeing the other person or whether we're seeing a reflection of ourselves. We have a strong reaction. That always says more about us than it does the other person. Good comment. Carolyn.
I liked talking about the ordinariness of things and paying attention. It seems to me that in that middle place, especially if you're looking for spiritual experience and insight, you miss it because of the way it comes to us is usually in ordinary things.
Right.
And I'm thinking of my daughter was in Spain and I went to visit her, and there are all these hermits in the mountains right outside of this little town, Arnedo, and the people make miniature pilgrimages to visit the hermits. And so one of the Spanish people that went on the walk with us said, "That's the best hermit to visit." And I was expecting some spiritual insight about that. And so I said, "Why?" And he said, "He makes the best sandwiches."
There you go.
So if you know, if you're disappointed by the earthiness of that,
right. You
would lose the beauty of it.
Yeah. That's a great segue to the last part of this, which is how do we talk about destinations? What is the end of a pilgrimage? Historically, there's a tension between the medieval view, which was very tied up first with Jerusalem, and then with the cities that had to do with the saints and the relics of the original disciples of Jesus. So Jerusalem was a pilgrimage site, the cities of Paul became pilgrimages. Rome, the city of Peter, Santiago, the city of St. James, Cologne, the city of the three wise men. Each of these became a pilgrimage site. And there was this sense in the medieval literature that you would get to that place and have some kind of spiritual high, insight, whatever. When we went to Iona, I tried to use pilgrimage language deliberately just to see what I would learn from people's reactions. And some of my friends acted like I was going to get to this little island off Scotland and tingle. And I've told people here that if I tingled, it was only because of the strength of the wind. It was shivering. It was very, very cold there. But it's more earthly than this tingling, this otherworldly kind of thing, though that expectation still overrides it. And I think we need to be really careful for the subtle or not so subtle implication that God is somehow in some other holy place more than God is anywhere else. I mean, it isn't like you need to get to Rome and then God will be there. In fact, there is this wonderful little ditty. "For God on earth, though long you've sought him, you'll miss in Rome unless you brought him." God is no more there than anywhere else. And I would want to say that the point of the attentiveness, that's the whole middle part of the journey, is for the sake of attentiveness wherever else you go. The Celts also practiced pilgrimage on the British Isles. Ireland, Scotland, the Celtic part of Christianity. But their view of pilgrimage was very different than having a destination. They were much more in the wandering, nomadic, perpetual pilgrims. They called themselves peregrines. The peregrine falcon is named for the Celtic pilgrims. Always in exile for the sake of conformity to Christ. For that abandonment. Jesus was homeless, his whole life wandered. So in conformity to Christ would do that and seek transformation then, change of their person, an internal change to become the heart of Christ. No matter how you define it, you face a huge tension between journey and destination. You know, at supper tonight, I sat by somebody who had just been to Holden Lake. I said, "That's my favorite hike." And she said back to me, "It's my favorite destination." There is all, whenever you take a trip, how much is it about where you're going and how much is it the process of going there? When you work at a school, you face that with education. How much of it is getting that diploma and how much of it is learning to learn and being about the learning? We have a comment.
When I was an assistant principal at a school in California, the students were very focused on what was going to happen after high school. And every time I would print out their schedules for the semester, there was a little place where I could write a comment. And I always typed in, "It's all about the journey." Because they were so focused on what was going to happen at the end of that, they never took time to enjoy and to engage in fully the journey to get there.
When people come, and I send somebody to Holden Lake, it is my favorite hike. The advice I give is on the way back, remember to look up.
Yeah.
You need to look at your feet. That's important, but you've got to look up.
And you have to stop to do that.
Yeah, well, or move slowly. I mean, Bradley, when he was teaching this, illustrated the difference between the story in Acts of the conversion of St. Paul and the story at the end of the Gospel of Luke, which is the transformation of Cleopas. St. Paul is struck by a blinding light, hears the voice of Jesus, and immediately comes to faith, has this epiphany, an epiphanic moment. Cleopas in Luke has this wandering journey where Jesus comes to walk with him and his companion. College students love it because Cleopas gets sarcastic. You know, we were talking about the things that have happened in Jerusalem, and Jesus says, "What things? Are you the only one in Jerusalem who doesn't know what's happened?" And Jesus says, "What things?" And they narrate it. They get to tell the whole story. And they invite him to stay, beg him to stay, and then in the breaking of bread, he is made known to them. And there is this, it's about the journey, this much more gradual thing. But even with the journey, how do we talk about this has been the huge challenge. This is what I'm testing out. I want to talk about a sacramental encounter with God. By sacramental, I mean God is in the ordinary stuff. Jesus became a human being. God is in bread and wine. God is in water. God is in other people, normal people. And if this will be an embarrassingly short course on the sacraments, but it gives us some breadth to talk about different kinds of experiences we can have on a pilgrimage. Roman Catholics who have lived with transubstantiation as the understanding of Christ's presence in the bread and wine, the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, can teach us so much about mystery and awe and reverence. It is the body of Christ. There are monastic orders that are called perpetual adoration, and their charism is to adore the presence of God in the sacrament. I think awe and wonder is a gift, and it is certainly something we seek in pilgrimage, or we seek in transformation, or in healing, or in growth. The kind of aha moment is valid. And sometimes it comes, but it doesn't always come. And I don't think it's the only way we want to talk about pilgrimage. Our friends in the Reformed tradition, that would be Presbyterians, Reformed Church, to some degree Methodists, largely talk about sacraments symbolically. They are, the bread and wine are symbols of the body and blood of Christ. I once said to a Presbyterian friend, "How can you say it's just a symbol?" He said, "Only Lutherans and Catholics accuse us of saying just a symbol." We didn't say just a symbol. We said it is a symbol And I'm aware of how many times when we travel, the trip becomes a metaphor for something else. I only need to say the word baggage, and you know what I mean. Baggage is suitcases and the stuff you put in it. Baggage is all the other kind of stuff you carry, psychologically, emotionally, in memory, things that need healing. Things like finding our way. I mean, that has literal meaning in a strange land, but it also has a profound metaphoric meaning for figuring out where we're going next. Lutherans believe that what makes a sacrament is the word. It's the promise of God given with the bread and wine. This is the body of Christ. And as a dyed-in-the-wool Lutheran, that's why I am focusing very much on what it means to bring language to the journey, to describe it, to write it out, to tell the story, to give it narrative. So by talking about sacramental encounter, I think we're able to say we meet things that are symbols of what we're looking for, we meet things that have to give us awe and wonder, or we meet things that we have to describe and learn from and listen to and wonder about along the way. And ultimately the promise is that God comes to us in these earthly ways. God meets us in these journeys. So my favorite quotation in the whole project is by Brother John of Tizay, who said he believes the true destination of a pilgrimage is not the holy site. We pass through the holy site to home, to return home in a new way. The destination is not the holy site, but home. You pass through the holy site to return home in a new way. Which I think is a beautiful way to think about we meet God on the way, in hopes that we can meet God anew at home. Nora Gallagher had been on a trip to Nicaragua, and she described her return this way. When I returned to Santa Barbara, everywhere I looked, the people who had been either invisible to me or a quaint backdrop to this town were suddenly real. The Latino gardener on the street with his leaf blower, the dishwasher in the back room of a restaurant, the old man sitting at the bus stop. I was shaken. I no longer wished to live as I had been living, working, eating, tending my marriage, dropping in on church. I wanted to have something to do with what I had seen in Nicaragua, because I knew that it was a glimpse of something else. If I could put into words, what I yearned for was to embody my shaky faith, to feel my faith in my flesh, acted out, incarnate. T.S. Eliot says the end is always the beginning. We arrive where we started, and we know the place for the first time. The irony of home, I think, is how often we need to leave it in order to see it and to see its gifts, to see God in the ordinary and the everyday. So I define pilgrimage as a departure from daily life in hopes and trust of a sacramental encounter with God. Questions? Comments? About destination. I mean, I think that whole passing through idea speaks to so many things. I'd like to think of worship that way. Worship is not the destination of the Christian faith. We pass through worship so that having practiced the presence of God and forgiveness and praise, we can live that.
Everyone. I was just thinking about how for some people, Christians particularly, they live with their eye on the destination, i.e. heaven.
Yeah.
And but what does it mean to really try to live into the middle, which is our earthly life?
I've often said that the only reason I can see for sleeping in a tent is that when you come home, you're so grateful for your food.
Well, we need to talk. There are many other very good reasons to sleep. Get in touch with the earth. Our friend, Jeff, mutual friend Jeff, who teaches at the National Outdoor Leadership School, says, you don't really appreciate sleeping on the ground until about the 21st now. So, just a couple poems to wrap things up, the first of which is very familiar, but I think speaks wonderfully of pilgrimage, by John Newton. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. And there's this poem to the pilgrim that was found etched on the wall of a monastery in Mallorca. Set out, you were born for the road. Set out, you have a meeting to keep. Where? With whom? Perhaps with yourself. Set out, your steps will be your words, the road your song, the weariness your prayers, and at the end, the silence will speak to you. Set out, alone or with others, but get out of yourself. You've created rivals, you will find companions. You envisage enemies, you will find brothers and sisters. Set out. Your head does not know where your feet are leading your heart. Set out. You were born for the road, the pilgrim's road. Someone is coming to meet you, is seeking you. In the shrine at the end of the road, in the shrine at the depths of your heart. He is your peace. He is your joy. Go. God already walks with you. Thanks for coming. I would tell you to go, but don't go very far. Worship, you can go get a drink of water.